Once upon a time, we fueled our machines with energy. We grew on farms. But then came the clash of industrialists between Henry Ford and John D. Rockefeller. And we have been fueling our machines with petroleum ever since. So today we pause to ask, how did Prohibition turn us away from plants toward petroleum?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1256th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Guaymas who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, things seem to go along as they go along until a conflict arises that forces a change. One example would be the way in which we went from growing our energy on farms to mining it from the earth. To understand how this happened, we need only look to the early days of the 1900s to the conflict between two of America's great industrialists, Henry Ford, who founded the Ford Motor Company, and John D. Rockefeller, who founded Standard Oil Company. Henry Ford was famous for mass-producing cars and tractors that everybody could, pretty much everyday people could afford to use. He fueled them with alcohol distilled from the crops grown on farms, and in doing so, he really put rural America on wheels instead of on hooves. John D. Rockefeller was famous for developing the petroleum industry, and in doing so, put city people on wheels too. Two great industrialists, two ways of fueling America. One had to win out, right? And that leads us to ask, how did Prohibition turn us from plants to petroleum? And who better to ask than my friend David Bloom, who is the farmer at Whiskey Hill Farms in Freedom, California. He is the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and he is the proprietor of Bloom Distillation. Welcome back, Dave.
Well, hello, Michael.
Great to have you back. Well, since we last talked, things have been moving right along in the world of alcohol. You've almost single-handedly brought alcohol back into the consciousness of America, and you've done it through your incredible book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, which I would drop it on the table, you know, to demonstrate the weight of this book. But if I did, the computer would fly up about 6 feet. It's that big.
Yes, it has a good thump factor.
Yep. And, well, it took you 4 years working full-time. What on earth was the alcohol apple that fell on your head that led you into pursuit of this alcohol jihad?
Well, an alcohol jihad, that's a really good contra position.
Yeah, juxtaposition
there.
Right?
Yes. Well, actually, I'm a local guy. I went to SF State University, mm-hmm. and as an ecologist and biosystematist. And one of my chief, very interesting teachers, Doc Sweeney, was writing something on the board one day, and we were talking about fermentation. We had a big bottle of yeast fermenting on the table, bubbling away.
Bubble, bubble, bubble.
Exactly. Those of you who know make beer know exactly what I'm talking about. And he turned around, kind of threw off a half comment saying, and that stuff would run your car. Now, this teacher had his last year, on campus. And so he decided, and he told us right at the start of the semester, I'm going to lie to you guys, and I'm going to see who's paying attention. Those of you who sleep won't even notice. So I think I've got him dead to rights. So I jump up in the back room and say, you're a liar. And he was just waiting for me. He turned around and said, prove it. Oh, my gosh. He called me out in front of all my friends. So I had to go to the library, and I figured, gasoline's been the only fuel. There can't be anything else. And I found literally a 3-foot-tall stack of books while I piled them up that were all about the use of alcohol as a fuel before gasoline was ever invented.
And so who proved who what?
Well, he... actually, he was correct that alcohol would run a car.
You know? And trucks.
Well, trucks, buses, jets, airplanes, you know, almost anything with an engine actually ran on alcohol first before gasoline and then later diesel was ever invented.
So let's take us back. In alcohol can be a gas. We're going to be working on a story that takes place on page 11 of how many stories do you have on how many pages are in this? Let's see, 570 pages. So this is one story out of one page.
But, yes.
But it begins long before Rockefeller and Ford, this use of alcohol, does it?
It does, yes. Well, the automotive engine, the internal combustion engine, was supposedly invented by Nicholas Otto. Now, that's not automobile, that's O-T-T-O, Otto, and his first fuel was alcohol. So it goes right back to the start of the engine.
Mm-hmm. And maybe even before that? I mean, did we use alcohol for other kinds? Did we fuel other kinds of endeavors? Did we lamps or something like
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Farms have been making alcohol forever. It was one of the most useful chemicals and still is today in our pantheon of chemicals. So farmers, we grow corn or in particular apples. Everybody had an apple orchard. But back then, apples really tasted bad, and so nobody...
They weren't the big red delicious that we have today, right?
Or any of the 1,800 wonderful remaining varieties out there, but they were more like crab apples. And the reason why to have an apple orchard back in the pioneering days of America is because you needed to make alcohol. And so they'd ferment the apples and make an apple cider. And then if you distill the apple cider, which means you boil it up and the alcohol and water evaporate from it, you end up with apple jack or apple whiskey. Now, that was used for many, many things. For instance, there were many herbal medicines that people in the prairies made from plants they had learned from the Native Americans, and they would dissolve those plants in alcohol and have cures for many different things for themselves and their farm animals. They made pesticides and herbicides by putting certain plants mixed in with the alcohol to extract the active ingredients and then use those. Mm-hmm. If you had a cow, well, you wouldn't think about milking that cow without disinfecting. So, you know, basically alcohol was used as the best disinfectant money could buy. In fact, using alcohol as a disinfectant goes back 8,000 years to the Chinese, who are first credited with figuring out how to kill germs.
Wow. There it is.
So anyway, yeah, we use alcohol for a lot of things. And, of course, there was no electricity and there was no oil yet. So the way you were able to stay up past sundown was with an alcohol lamp. You know, the glass lamp that we nowadays attribute to kerosene actually was used with alcohol and a few drops of pine tar, because alcohol burns so clean it doesn't make much light. So a few drops of pine tar made a nice warm yellow flame. So alcohol had literally dozens of uses on the farm, and just like it does nowadays.
And one of the most fascinating uses of it was to concentrate value of a crop.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, if you lived way, way out away from the cities, like in Pennsylvania.
Monongahela, you know, Valley or
that's
something.
That's right. Out that way, you know, if you were trying to bring your crop, which was typically corn, into Boston, well, that's a 2-week, you know, horse ride to get there. So it was a lot better to take the corn and make it into mash, ferment it with yeast, distill it into alcohol, and take two little kegs, one on each side of the horse, all the way into Boston, and sell it for a lot more money because, you know, there were a lot of bars in Boston, and that's where the alcohol went.
So it was a concentrated form of cropping, and it provided a great way for government to get its fingers in your pocketbooks, right?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things there. First of all, you know what, we have a fancy word for it nowadays called value-added agriculture, right? Which, you know, was first attributed, you might say, to taking low-value corn and converting it into something worth a lot more money, meaning liquor. So yes, you know, we see a lot of the modern concepts of how we get back to the farm and away from industrial agriculture by adding value ourselves. Now, there were a lot of uses for alcohol, and in particular, as we just mentioned, lighting was a big one. But pretty quickly, we started using motors for things. And tractors, the earliest tractors, there was no gasoline, so they ran on alcohol. It wasn't like there was this big pool of stuff called gasoline sitting around, and someone said, God, I wish we had a motor that would run on that. You know, no, it was a byproduct of the oil industry, which came much later.
Much later. So we're up to like 1877 when Otto invents the infernal combustion engine.
And oil really was... not really common till well after that, you know.
How did they lubricate that engine without petroleum?
Well, the first engines were lubricated by soybean oil and also corn oil and several other oils. Peanut oil was common. You just changed it a bit more often than you do nowadays. But those engines ran a lot cooler than modern engines because they didn't have high compression. So they were less damaging to the engine oil. Yeah,
when you hear in one of those ancient engines running and they go pop, 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 you know, it's really fundamental kinds of things. But they
I don't know, Michael. I think you're talking about steam engines. You're dating yourself there.
Could be. Could be. But and so we come up with
But steam engines ran on alcohol,
right,
too.
Right.
You know, I mean, they started off on coal or wood, but before we got into internal combustion, we did run steam engines on alcohol.
Right. So internal combustion engines, and then along came a guy named Henry Ford, who figured out how to make a lot of these engines, so mass produce them. And mass-produced cars and tractors.
Tractors were first, yes.
Well, tractors were first.
Yes, absolutely. And Henry Ford was where he was revolutionary. He said, if I can't make an engine and a vehicle cheap enough where my workers couldn't afford it, then I'll never succeed as a businessman. So that was his claim to fame, is figuring out how to get the cost down from a handmade car. Like Lamborghinis nowadays are still made by one guy who makes all the parts and puts them together, but they are well over $250,000. So, you know, maybe you, Michael, can afford that, but, you know, I'd have to save up for a few years for that. But the idea was he figured out how to mass produce, and that changed agriculture all over the world. He exported engines to even as far away as New Zealand that ran on alcohol. And in New Zealand, they used sugar beets and sorghum to make their alcohol, fermenting those sugars, and running their agriculture mm-hmm. on it. And it's funny, today I'm looking to go back to New Zealand, and we're talking about converting agriculture and most of the country over to alcohol. As they strive to get rid of the importation of oil.
Which is probably pretty good. And if you've ever been to New Zealand, it's an agriculture paradise. They love growing things.
They do. And imagine a country that's maybe about the size of California, Oregon, and a little of Washington, but only 4 million people in the whole country. The whole country is farmers except for a couple of major cities.
You know, having been there, just flying into New Zealand, you can look down on it and go, wow, it's a farmer paradise. And you compare that to Australia and you go, totally different worlds. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with David Bloom today. We're talking about how we made the switch from living on plants and fueling our world on plants to petroleum. Do stay tuned.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place during the Battle of the Komondorski Islands, March 1943.
All the gunfire that had been aimed at the Salt Lake City was now coming directly for us. From my position up in the gun director atop the bridge, I could actually see the rounds coming from the Japanese cruisers. Captain would yell up, over or under? I'd yell my guess back down, and he'd give the helmsman his orders. Those Japs had their batteries lined up right, I'll tell you. They dropped a dozen shots, short. Then walk right up, as neat as you please. Their dispersion wasn't 20 feet, and that's what you want to see. Except, of course, if you happen to be on the wrong end of that gunfire. Hell, even the men down the fire room knew we were done for.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Just think of it. Not too long ago, we grew most of our energy. I mean, it wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't.
If you think about it, just a few decades ago.
I was getting up around 100 years
getting
now,
getting around
Michael.
100, yeah.
But that's still, that's a blink.
I mean, you were talking about China and how they figured out how to use alcohol 8,000 years ago to
disinfect. And probably a bit of lighting, too.
Yeah, what's 100 years in that kind of history, you know? So, but Henry Ford figured out how to really mass produce wheels. They put us on wheels, and he really put rural people on wheels. And he was also very clever about other things with respect to agriculture, too, and using the products of agriculture to make other things. And I recall seeing a video of him beating on a car with a sledgehammer.
That's correct.
That was made with cannabis.
It was. Hemp oil was... you know, transformed into plastic, and he made a plastic fender, and it was incredibly durable, as we all saw in that ancient video with him using a sledgehammer and pounding on it. And then alcohol, of course, has been used to make some of the highest quality lubricants on Earth, the polyol esters, which are called synthetic oils. And instead of being measured in dozens of hours of life, they were measured in thousands of hours of life for the synthetic oils, and dramatically increasing mileage, because the molecules were so big. They were like microscopic ball bearings, keeping your engine completely metal, no metal to metal. So we've actually, during World War II, when we were short of oil and everything went to the war, we made our lubricants out of alcohol and plant fat.
And you know, one industrial country of the world does not have much petroleum at all, and that would be Germany.
That's
right.
And
Germany presents a very interesting case study in alcohol.
Well, and it informed our farmers, too, because Germany was loaded with coal, but they they didn't win out in the lottery for oil. They didn't have any. So coal ran many of the things in Germany, but liquid fuels are so superior. They're energy dense. They're easy to transport. You know, it's not so difficult to burn them like it is
coal or wood. It's not even quite so dirty either.
Well, that's a whole other subject. Okay. But so what Germany did is, Germany was a big potato producer. Boy,
it's a big farm country.
Absolutely, like everywhere was back at the early 1900s. And so Germany instituted community distilleries. In other words, the distillery wasn't exactly a co-op, but it was cooperative, where the farmers would bring in their potatoes and they'd get back one-third of the alcohol. It was not a cash transaction, and that they could sell in their community to everyone mm-hmm. else for lighting and everything else. They get back all the pulp left over from the fermentation of the potatoes, and that they would feed to their pigs. Now, this gets back to exactly how plants are a source of energy for us. Because what plants do is this magic called photosynthesis.
And God's gift to planet Earth.
Oh, my gosh. If it wasn't for photosynthesis, this would be a pretty cold rock, let me tell you. So what photosynthesis is a plant has the mechanism to take in carbon dioxide from the air. So they breathe in what we breathe out. And they take water. So now you got carbo from carbon dioxide, hydrate from water. And to make it a carbohydrate, solar energy glues it together through the process of photosynthesis. So now you've got a carbohydrate. You can ferment that carbohydrate into alcohol. It's still got the same components, just arranged differently. When you burn the alcohol, what goes out the tailpipe is what you'd expect, carbon dioxide and water, what went in, actually. But the energy that glued it together, the solar energy that glued it together, explodes in the engine and drives you down the road. So you're literally driving on solar energy released from the carbohydrate.
Thank you, God.
Yes, thank you. And thank you, yeast. You know?
Now, before Germany instituted these communal distilleries, they had been subsidizing agriculture. And the farmers were, everybody was taking advantage of the subsidies. And soon there was an incredible surplus of potatoes, and everybody was going broke because they couldn't make enough money. But allowing that for those communal distilleries enabled for the farmers to concentrate the value. And so it really turned industry, turned Germany into an industrial country.
Well, it did, but what it also did is allow the farmers to make a decent living. Because when you make alcohol, well, it's worth a lot more than corn. Corn's only really good for animal feed in Germany, you know, or potatoes in this case. But in this country, you know, corn's about a nickel a pound, but alcohol's worth many, many times that. And there are many other things you can make from alcohol. So it's the start of an economy based on agriculture that made everything. There used to be a movement called the Kemmergists in the early 1900s that showed that anything you could make from oil, you could make from plants. And unfortunately, oil was so cheap that you couldn't compete economically, but plastics and drugs and everything that you could make from oil, you could make from building up from alcohol.
Mm-hmm. And Henry Ford was totally into this alcohol economy, but he made machines that could run on both alcohol and gasoline. How was that possible?
Well, you know, basically, as I said, alcohol is a carbohydrate. Now, what's different about a carbohydrate than a hydrocarbon is that there's oxygen in it. So hydrocarbons, like oil, they totally rely on oxygen from the air to burn. But alcohol, being about 29% oxygen by weight, burns more completely because the alcohol is incorporated into the compound and oxygenates the ignition of the rest of the alcohol. Where gasoline, well, has a hard time getting air all the way into the middle of a droplet. So you get all this intermediate kind of half-burned stuff that goes out in the exhaust, which we now call smog. Mm-hmm. So alcohol was more efficient. And actually, you and I were talking about airplanes prior to going on the air today. And alcohol is the superior aircraft fuel. It's 106 octane, so high compression, plane engines, you know, piston engines okay. need that. But the other thing, as you go higher and higher in the atmosphere,
there you get.
There's less and less air and oxygen. So alcohol actually maintains its efficiency where gasoline's efficiency goes down and down and down as the higher you go. So Gordon Cooper, the astronaut, discovered he was getting better fuel consumption on alcohol than on gasoline when he flew his Cessna across country and
wow.
documented all that.
So let's go to Ford and Rockefeller. Ford was very much a proponent of making these equipment available to the folks that lived out in the country where most people lived at the time. Rockefeller was heading in a different direction, though, right?
Well, Rockefeller's interest was, you know, not the country. His interest was himself and money and power. You know, mm-hmm. the idea that you could monopolize the entire country's energy supply was near and dear to him. And that's what he strove for, and he actually over time succeeded. To the point where nowadays, you know, if you go to the store and you want to buy tomato sauce, well, there's 10 different brands there, you know. But if you go to the gas station or fuel station and you're looking for different fuels, you can buy gasoline and you can buy gasoline
and
then
buy gasoline.
A little gasoline. So you know, the idea that the oil companies created a monopoly actually was one of the largest monopolies on earth.
How did they go about capturing the city? Because out in the country, farmers had their, you know, they had their stills, and we can grow our own fuel. We don't need any help from outside.
No, we don't.
But in the city, we're helpless, aren't we?
Well, no. I lived in San Francisco, and I had a distillery there back in the late 70s, early 80s. And, well, you know, I didn't have any crops there to make alcohol. But, you know, I'm very clever at looking for surpluses, things that other people don't have a use for. And I noticed, because my father was a policeman in San Francisco, they ate a lot of donuts. But they didn't eat all the donuts.
And so, donuts are what? Carbohydrates.
That's right. They're wheat flour and then lots of sugar. And then, of course, they're fried in fat. So I had a distillery out in Hunter's Point, the industrial part of San Francisco. And we would take the donuts. And I'd left, you know, drums at a donut shop. And they put all the extra donuts in there. And I'd haul them off. And I brought it to my distillery. And we cooked the batch up. And as I cooked it up, where I add enzymes and break starch down, like Mr. Chemistry here, but what floated on top was all that donut fat, you know, from being deep fried. And that doesn't ferment. You couldn't make that into alcohol. But I skimmed that off, and I used it as fuel oil to fire my still. So I had a feedstock, a raw material that provided its own energy for distillation. So I made alcohol from donuts. And, you know, when I went down the street, there was a faint aroma of donut fat behind my car.
What did you do with the alcohol in San Francisco?
Well, I ran my 53 Chevy fire truck.
There you go.
It was a ton and a half that I got on a city auction. And I drove all over San Francisco. And at the time, I was mostly in the trade. So, you know, parking's always a problem in the city. But since
if you have a fire truck.
I would just park right at the fire hydrants, and I'd go do my plumbing jobs.
So how did John D. Rockefeller go about fueling the city with petroleum? I mean, it seems like such a messy job.
Well, he invented the service station, because when it was out in the rural areas, you could stop at any farm and barter or pay for some alcohol to get back to town. Even if it was a gasoline vehicle, Henry Ford's engines, eventually he had to work with the market as it was, and so he made his vehicles able to run on both alcohol or gasoline. So if you left the city running on gasoline, which is where gasoline was sold, it wasn't sold out in the country yet, you'd have to stop by a farm to get home, and you'd pour alcohol in the tank. Now, there are differences between alcohol and gasoline. So Henry Ford arranged for you to be able to switch from one to the other. It was pretty simple. See, as I mentioned, alcohol has oxygen built in and gasoline doesn't. So you need less from the air, less oxygen. So you could adjust what was prior to fuel injection, the item called the carburetor, which mixed the air and the fuel, and you could adjust that. And if you look at my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, you'll see pictures of these things on the old Model A's and T's. So you could turn a knob on the dashboard and change the air fuel mixture. Mm-hmm. And then
like you do when you're flying an airplane.
Exactly. Yeah. Like you're flying an airplane, because that's done manually, because you're changing an elevation.
Changing altitude all the time.
And you're looking at your exhaust temperature and you're tuning it just right. And you're using, you know, you're using that digital processor, you know, 10 digits in your brain, you know, to make these changes. And then alcohol, of course, is 106 octane. Gasoline back then was 50 octane.
Wow. You know,
they didn't have octane boosters other than alcohol, which came later. So they, to deal with the knocking or pinging of the engine, you had to change when the spark plug fired. And that was done from within the cockpit of the car as well. And you could we used to say it was a digital distributor that sent the spark, because it took the five digits of your left hand to move the lever on, you know, on the steering column that said when the spark plug would fire. Now, that's all done automatically nowadays by computers. But back then, you had to use the gray stuff between your ears and
your
listen.
Ears and yeah, your senses, and listen to the engine and what does it sound like there. But it was possible
to go from alcohol to gasoline anywhere you were.
So Rockefeller figured out how to build service stations around town.
Right.
And therefore, city people could be on wheels as well, because they could get their gasoline down the street, drive around. If they wanted to go for a drive in the country, they could pull some levers on their car and pull into a farm and meet a farmer and get some alcohol and keep going.
Be just like stopping and buying milk or vegetables somewhere, you know. People, every farmer was a business person at that time.
Wow. And then, but there's two different ways of fueling the world, and it seems like they were kind of complementary, but not complementary enough to keep going. So something somewhere along the line sparked this conflict between these two great industrialists.
Sparked. I like that, Michael. That's a good pun. So yeah, basically, as I said, Rockefeller was dead set on monopoly and controlling the whole market because he saw what a good deal making fuel and selling it was. So he embarked on a very interesting campaign, which nowadays we'd call, you know, oh, I don't know, we've heard it in the press all the time, fake news and misinformation and whatever. And so he cast alcohol as the evil of society, and he enlisted a little fringe group.
Carrie Nation.
Carrie Nations was the one we remember of the Women's Christians Temperance Movement. Kind of think of them as, you know, some kind of fringe political group inflamed by an industrialist. And so they were funded to the tune of $4 million. Now, this is back in the 1900s. $4 million was a lot of money.
Okay, we're gonna pick this up when back, because this is where things are really starting to get interesting. How prohibition turned us away from plants to petroleum. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with David Bloom, who is the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. Put it on your shelf in your library. You can read it forever, and it'll enrich you forever. We will be right back talking about the Ford-Rockefeller conflict and how prohibition turned us away from plants.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Herbal Connections, Maureen Rogers. I rate MetroFarm very high. All of the information is easy to understand and it reads really fast. You will get your money's worth out of MetroFarm. Ag economist Dr. John Wyson.
Olson's Metro Farms enjoy competitive advantages which allow them to produce more crops per unit of higher quality at less cost than large-scale farms.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yeah, and it's really true. There's a lot to say here, and so far we've covered about one paragraph of David Bloom's Alcohol Can Be a Gas, talking about the evolution of our fueling, our energy sources, how we went from living on plant energy to living on petroleum energy, from carbohydrates to hydrocarbons. And of course, Ford was the one who really taught us how to use alcohol in machines. And Rockefeller came along and said, no, we're going to use petroleum. So he enlisted the help of Carrie Nation and the Women's, what is it?
Christian Temperance Movement.
Yeah, Women's Christian Temperance Union. Those are the gals that went into the bar with axes.
And or umbrellas. And umbrellas. They would bat people over the head saying, lips that touch alcohol will never touch mine. So the thing was, he got a fringe group to go out there and campaign. So publicly there was so-called opposition to alcohol. And then Rockefeller went in through the Women's Christian Temperance Movement and donated money to every member of Congress to go ahead and vote for a bit of legislation that would ban the making, transporting, consuming, anything to do with alcohol, which later became known as prohibition.
So he went and paid these hard-drinking, whiskey-drinking congressmen to outlaw the stuff that they loved to drink.
That's right. And they were all men except for one woman who drank more than the rest of them. She was from Wyoming.
Montana.
Montana. Yeah. Oh, that's correct. I knew it was out there in the middle. So anyway, so the idea was everybody who was in Congress thought, well, I'll vote for this. I'll take the money. But of course, it'll never pass. But they all voted for it. And so 2/3 majority voted for it. It was a constitutional amendment, which was almost impossible to undo. It took decades before a big enough vote would come up to overturn this law. But overnight, alcohol became illegal, and you couldn't put it in your car, you couldn't use it in industry, and you couldn't drink it. Of course, everyone drank it anyway because everybody continued to make alcohol off in the woods or in their basement or whatever. And we had people who made it at night by the light of the moon and became known as moonshiners, you know.
And throughout rural America, which had been living essentially on alcohol for many, many different things, all of a sudden there's no alcohol, or at least no legal alcohol.
No,
so
legal
what
alcohol.
Impact did that have on rural America?
Well, it started the rural electrification movement. In other words, people didn't have light anymore, you know, without alcohol, at least not without legal alcohol. So we started putting out the old great 32-volt system of electricity prior to it switching over to Thomas Edison's 110 AC. So we electrified the rural America so that we could at least have light. And at first it was a decentralized system mimicking alcohol. And then just like oil taking over as a monopoly over the fuel supply, electricity, then the system was changed to be something that could not be easily produced at home at the time and had to be sent by transmission lines. In other words, AC power. And the Edison Company was chosen to be the monopoly for that. So this is a pattern that goes on and on. Now, you know, we used
The trend toward oligarchy.
Or oiligarchy.
Oiligarchy.
Well, you know, rope used to all be made out of marijuana fiber, mm-hmm. You know.
Hemp fiber, yeah.
Hemp fiber. And it was like the best rope. It was very flexible, wore well. It was not easily abraded. And then DuPont came along with a petroleum product called nylon. And they said, wow, we can make great rope out of this, but we can never make it as cheap as hemp. Because hemp was a byproduct of making other things from the marijuana plant.
So what
plant.
Do we do? Let's say, well, we'll go to Congress and we'll donate a lot of money to these congressmen and convince them to make cannabis illegal.
And prohibit it.
Prohibit it, yeah. And
so,
there we are.
And so corporations, if they get a strategy, repeat it over and over again. And so prohibition worked once. Why not again? So Christopher Carr, a local, local hemp and canna guy, and I have gone over and over all the different ways in which the way alcohol was treated by big corporations is exactly how the plant medicine or plant substance, substances have been regulated for the benefit of big corporations. And so, you know, the thing about this, though, just like prohibition of alcohol, it didn't stop people from smoking marijuana.
No.
People just started growing
it. On the contrary, it called such great attention to cannabis that everybody figured out there must be something good in it if it's that bad.
Yeah, or at least there was money in it.
There's money in it, yeah.
Because, and so anyway, we seem to keep making the same mistakes. But now we're up against bigger and bigger concentrated power. Mm-hmm. And so it takes extra vigilance on our behalf to maintain our democracy and our freedom from corporate domination. It's not politics by party. It's
politics
corporation,
by money
and control. And
these are the two things that you see always. Yeah.
And that's what Rockefeller demonstrated was important, and he won.
And
you know?
He won. How did he win, though? Was it just by buying off everybody?
Yes, by making alcohol legal for long enough that he was able to.
So through prohibition lasted, 30 years?
almost. And what it did was it was repealed right around the start of the Great Depression because farmers were going broke and they had to open up the markets again for farmers. So get this. Here we are in the middle of a pandemic. Now, I have an alcohol plant. Obviously, I should help my neighbors and my country by making sanitizer. The primary ingredient, of course, is high-proof alcohol to
disinfect. Has to be above, what, 70%?
About 70% is where it's really effective. So, you know, just using 40% vodka, you know, it helps some.
Best to drink it.
Well, you know, well, like we like to say, drink the best and drive the rest, you know. So anyway, here I am making sanitizer, and I get a deal with the country of Barbados that is having a big problem with COVID, and they want to have sanitizer, and they were willing for me to send it to them in shipping containers and tanks, right? Well, I find out that all of a sudden, alcohol made in the United States or sanitizer made in the United States cannot be exported.
Because it's a strategic product that everybody that we need here and we can't share with anybody else. Is that the reason?
That's the argument. But what the real reason is the oil companies under this current administration have been crushing farmers and alcohol for the last 4 years. If you suddenly make this high-value market available to farmers in this country, remember, sanitizer sells for $1 to $2 an ounce. That's over $100 to $200 a gallon. Suddenly, all the alcohol plants in the Midwest that were having trouble would not be having trouble. They'd be selling some of their products.
It would be kind of similar to what happened in Germany, you know, when they allowed farmers to have their head and develop their communal distilleries. The rural countryside flourished.
Oh, totally. There were 70,000 regional distilleries in Germany, all small scale, a couple of million gallons a year each. That's all. I mean, my little farm, I only make about 100,000 gallons a year, but in just a little more space, I could make a million gallons per year. So, you know, it's totally doable on the decentralized scheme. But by making sure politically at every step of the way the oil companies fight alcohol, even something as benign as exporting it for sanitizer has to be stopped, just has to be corralled so that farmers don't get to keep the value of their work.
And it seems like we always come down to this when I look at how power and control becomes centralized. It always revolves around the economic principle of economies of scale. Whereas if you're John D. Rockefeller, you know, you can donate $4 million to the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and it would be a drop in the bucket. And you can buy, you know, all the congressmen, which he did. And but because you're own Standard Oil, you have this massive scale. So all of these purchases are minuscule. But if you're a farmer in Winnemucca, Nevada, and you try to influence Congress, what do you do? All of those costs would be prohibitive.
But if you're in Iowa, alcohol plants there contribute heavily to candidates that are in favor of alcohol, whichever party it's in. And so you find in the Midwest very favorable votes by those politicians for renewable fuel. And you get to California with our wonderful long-term Senator Dianne Feinstein conspiring with an Oklahoma senator to go ahead and get minimum requirements for alcohol reversed in Congress. So the battle goes on today. You know, we have alcohol in all of
this
our gasoline.
This kind of takes us back to Teddy Roosevelt, doesn't it?
Gee, Teddy Roosevelt. Now,
he was the one who removed the existing excise tax on industrial alcohol.
That was correct. Yeah, there was this giant tax put on, and that excise tax actually started at the start of the country because, you know,
George Washington, right? You got to pay for the war.
You got to pay for the war. And so the Revolutionary War happened. They were going to tax the land, you know, that the rich owned along the coast there. And the rich said, oh, no, no, no. We're not going to pay the taxes. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, you know, there you go.
Big entities not wanting to pay taxes. So they put the tax on alcohol to pay for the Revolutionary War bills. Now, this was very unpopular to a large number of guys who were just fighting out there in the woods against the British, right? And so they weren't exactly sheep.
Yeah, we're giving you our bodies to fight for your country, and then you're going to make us pay for that?
Yeah. So what they did is they refused. And so they would turn back the revenue agents from the government, usually covered with tar and feathers, and refuse. And so Washington had to mobilize and draft, because there were no volunteers for this kind of duty, to go out to Pennsylvania and put down what they used to call the white Indians of Pennsylvania, meaning the moonshiners.
Yeah.
They weren't called moonshiners yet, but they went out there to suppress the farmers. Well, these farmers had just spent years as guerrilla fighters in the Revolutionary War against the British. They just disappeared into the hills. So Washington's 20,000-person, you know, little expeditionary force had to go back with nothing to show for it. But everybody understood at that point that the game was up, just like marijuana here. You weren't going to be able to grow it legally out in the open, your alcohol right. crops. So they had to go off and do their distilling out in the woods. By the light of the moon.
By the light of the moon became moonshiners. And then Teddy Roosevelt came in, looked at the situation, and said, well, we're going to still tax liquor, alcohol,
yes.
but we're going to take tax away from industrial alcohol, and that really opened up the world for the Henry Fords, and that
opened it back up. What it used to be, where everything was prohibited. So I have a license to make alcohol now, and I got a license for everything. So I can make sanitizer, I can make liquor, I can make fuel for cars, but there are different rules for each product. So the taxes still apply to any time the alcohol is pure, because it could be consumed as a beverage. So we have very complex tax laws around alcohol. So if I make it for sanitizer, I have to put certain things in the sanitizer to make sure you're not likely to drink it. Things like eucalyptus oil. Oh, believe me, you will never drink alcohol with eucalyptus oil. It smells so bad. But if I was to sell alcohol without any of these smelly products, then I'd have to pay the full beverage tax, which is a lot of money. Now, Ronald Reagan, back in his era, his people figured out that $10 of $10.40 tax went to enforcement. Only 40 cents was collected on alcohol taxation.
David Bloom, we're out of time. Can you believe that? That just went by too fast. But I want to commend you for turning our thoughts back to plants. From hydrocarbons back to carbohydrates. And the whole new world that we can realize by going there. Thank you so much all for tuning in, Food Chain Radio program.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.